The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 228 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce two co-hosts. First is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Happy holidays, everyone. Welcome to this year's holiday edition of Airplane Geeks.
That's right. And also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
And we're all going to be singing all night, aren't we?
God, I hope not. Our guest this episode is David White. He goes by Whitey, and he's a longtime member of both the International Council of Air Shows and the Northeast Council of Air Shows, where he's also a board member. Whitey, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on, Max. I appreciate it. And I'd sing, but nobody wants to hear me sing, least of all me.
Yeah, please don't. Please don't. Now, you've been the air operations manager at the Toronto Air Show and also air boss at the Waterloo, Ontario Air Show. Are you also a producer at the Waterloo Show?
Yes, that's right. The Waterloo Air Show has been going on for 4 years now. We're about to have our fifth. And for the first 2 years, I was the air boss. And then in 11 and 12, I was co-producer with my business partner, Richard Cooper.
All right. Well, listen, we're happy to have you with us on this episode. We're all obviously air show fans, and it's going to be fun and interesting to talk to you about air shows and some of the issues associated with them and how they work and all that. And we'll have that coming up.
Looking forward to it.
Before, though, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. Also coming up, David, what do you have for us this week?
Bit of a surprise, but anybody who's listened to the podcast over the last 3 years knows that the week before Christmas, I come up with something new every year.
Also coming up, we have Stephen Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk Report. And also Peter Johnson, our European contributor, has a special Across the Pond segment. We'll finish up with some listener mail. We might even get a few Grill the Geeks questions in there. And we'll look forward to those. All right, let's get started right away with the aviation news from the past week. Everyone ready?
Ready.
Our first item comes from USA Today. This is Airline Mergers Haven't Raised Fares, report says. Now, this article is about a report that's come out recently from the consulting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they've looked at what has been the impact of all these airline mergers we've seen. And we have had a number of them here in the U.S., starting in perhaps 2005, when U.S. Airways and America West joined up. We had the Delta and Northwest merger in 2008. 2010 saw the Continental and United link up, and then in 2011, Southwest closed on their purchase of AirTran. The issue that some people have raised is, have these mergers resulted in increased airfares? And some have claimed that they have, that these haven't been in the best interests of the flying public. But what this report says is that, yeah, while airline fares have increased 22% from the second quarter of 2009, that was in kind of an economic trough, a downturn. When you look at the longer term, you get really different results altogether. If you go back before the U.S. Airways and America West merger to the beginning of 2004, you find that the fare increase has only been 1.8% at an annual rate. And when you adjust that for inflation, it's actually down 1% per year. I don't know if this comes as a surprise to you guys. I don't know. Rob, had you ever thought that these mergers were, in effect, causing prices to go up?
Well, as much as I don't want to disagree with Henry, I kind of have a little trouble with this one because I think if you're going to make these kind of grand statements and sort of aggregate fares across the entire country, maybe you can make that argument work. I don't know. I'm not an economist, but I bet there are a whole lot of cities that have seen a whole lot of fare increases in the past few years. And I think of one that just sticks out in my mind. I mean, we used to get out to Sarasota regularly because of the house we had down there. And we used to be able to do O'Hare to Tampa, and we drove down from there. But we used to be able to do O'Hare, Tampa, return. Oh, this is probably 5 years ago. But $85 for whatever it's worth. And since I still have family that lives down there, we looked at it on many different occasions during the year. And there's no way you can get down to Tampa from O'Hare these days for anything less than maybe $450, $500. So, you know, again, is that a one-time shot? Well, maybe, but I'll bet you if we asked our listeners to tell us what they think about this one, I'll bet you they'd be hard-pressed not to come up with a couple of examples of where the fares have gone up in just pure dollars.
And another issue is all the fees, right? The ancillary fees. And this report does talk about that. It seems in the old days you could talk about airfare, and that was pretty much it. There was airfare and there was taxes, but that was kind of limited to airfare. Now, if you want to talk about what's the total cost to fly from point A to point B, you've got to look at the fees involved as well.
Absolutely. And of course, even if you look back before all the laws were put together that forced the airlines to disclose every single fee, the dollars just don't seem to link up to me. And again, how they can say that they have not gone up when airlines have cut routes and cut frequency. And I don't know. Maybe we need to get Henry on here to explain that to us in terms that those of us that didn't do as well in the math high school cannot understand, because I'm having a little trouble with it.
On the ancillary fees, the report does make note that over this period of time, the baggage fees have come to add about 3% more to the total cost. But all fees together amounts to around 9% above the average airfare, or the base airfare. So it's an interesting report. We'll put the link in the show notes. It's about, I think, an 8-page PDF. If you want to look for it on your own, you can go to www.pwc.com, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and search for the report. It's called Aviation Perspectives, Airline Mega Merger Impact on the U.S. Domestic Airline Industry. And it's got some other interesting things. It looks at the transportation wage index and how that has contributed, and also it looks at the price of oil and how that may have also impacted the changes in airfares that we see. All right, we have another story. This is from AvWeb. Fuel control malfunction caused F-18 crash. This story relates to the crash of a Royal Canadian Air Force CF-18. During rehearsal for the air show in Lethbridge, Alberta. This was back in July 2010. And we also got a YouTube link, a video sent in by Jamie Dodson, which is fairly dramatic. And in this incident, this accident, the pilot ends up ejecting from punching out of the airplane at not very high, 200 or 300 feet off the ground, I think. David, you're somewhat familiar with this because of your involvement in the air shows, I think.
I am, actually, and the pilot of that plane is a friend of mine, Brian Buse.
I guess he was okay, but I guess he sustained some vertebrae compression kinds of issues.
Yeah, he got pretty badly scraped up and banged up. It was a very windy day in Lethbridge, and when he hit the ground, the parachute didn't collapse and dragged him across the runway. And he had some compressed vertebrae. If you look closely at the pictures, one of the worst things you see when a pilot ejects out of an airplane is if his head is bent down. And unfortunately, Brian's head was down when he came out of the airplane. So a lot of strains and pains. And I think he was about 8 months before he got back in an airplane. And he's just, it was 18 months before he was back in an airplane with an ejection seat. So he's flying Hawks now out of Moose Jaw.
Wow. Well, we're glad that he survived that accident. I guess what was happening was the F-18, he was making an extremely slow pass, or you slow the aircraft down as much as you can, super high angle of attack. The thrust of the engines are kind of what's also trying to, hold the plane and give it some lift. And I think what happened here is that he lost an engine, and this report indicates that it was likely a stuck ratio boost piston in one of the engines. But when you're doing this maneuver and you lose an engine, you just don't have, you don't have lift, and the F-18 really quickly went out of control. You know, it's amazing how fast he punched out of there. When you watch the video, you can see it starting to go wrong, and then just that it's going to go really wrong, and just in the blink of an eye, he's punched right out of there. It's kind of an amazing video.
Yeah,
I think they're taught to do that. I mean, that in that kind of a situation, and in a civilian airplane, you're almost behind the power curve, and it. Anything so much as coughs, you're in deep doo-doo. Well, and I'm sure for those guys when they're, I don't know, how high was that guy off the ground, David? Maybe 100 feet or something? Maybe 200 feet? I don't know.
No, he was, he starts that maneuver at 250 feet, and it was very well described by Max as a high alpha maneuver. They do it about 25 degrees nose up. The airplane with two good engines is actually capable of 35 degrees nose up. So that's their little bit of margin of error. And what they do is about center stage, they go to full afterburner, and it's really neat to watch because the airplane stays at the same angle of attack and just starts to climb as the afterburner kicks in and the thrust increases. Well, the left engine went to full afterburner and the right engine stayed at flight idle, which, of course, as you can imagine, created quite a bit of adverse yaw. And Rob's absolutely right. They are trained very well when they do the demos. They start practicing those in November of the previous year, and they're taught that at every place during the demonstration, if there is an engine failure, what to do. Unfortunately, with the high alpha maneuver, if the engine fails at particularly that moment, just get out of the airplane. And you can see him go to full afterburner. If you look really closely, you can see the nozzle on the left engine open up. The nozzle on the right engine stays closed, and then you see the rudders go full over to the left, and as the nose of the airplane starts to continue over to the right, he punches out.
We're out of here.
Yeah.
This belongs to the insurance company now.
Whitey, when you're involved in an air show and you have some of these, some of these military demonstration flights where the power is great, the forces are great. Do you have a little bit of butterflies, in your stomach, or do you always just assume that everything is going to be just fine? I mean, do they make you a little bit nervous sometimes?
Butterflies, yes. Nervous, no. I have an unending confidence in the training and the equipment that these guys are using. When you look at the number of, if you just looked at the number of F-18 demonstration flights there are in the run of a year, consider that the Blue Angels every weekend, they have 7 jets operating all weekend, 6 doing the demo. They probably do a total of, including practice, 25 to 30 demonstration type flights every single weekend. That's just the Blue Angels. Then the Navy's got a couple of demo jets that are out doing what they call TAC demos. The Royal Canadian Air Force has a jet that's going around doing every weekend doing TAC demos. The fact that we lose an airplane once every 5 to 7 years, that's pretty good odds. So do I get butterflies watching them? Absolutely. It never ceases to amaze me, the sound of an F-16 or the rate of climb of a Raptor, the maneuverability of these airplanes. Never ceases to amaze me. But to be honest, when I'm airbossing the show, a problem never enters my mind.
Now, isn't it pretty much well established, I guess internationally, that air show performers are separated from the spectators in a way that should a problem develop, the momentum of the direction that they're flying would not endanger the spectators. Is that a fair statement?
That's an absolutely fair statement. In the U.S., you guys have the FARs. In Canada, we have the CARs. In each of those, they're almost identical, although there's some slight differences in the air show section of the regulations. The Canadian aviation regulations are federal aviation regs. And one of the absolute rules for civilians, performers, and the military, while they have their own set of regs, generally follow this, is there can be no energy vectored towards the crowd at any time. So if the aircraft has a problem, it doesn't end up in the crowd. There are, if you want to do a 360-degree turn, for example, at show center, there is a minimum altitude you have to, or a maximum altitude, I should say, you have to be at. And there's a maximum and minimum distance you can be away from the crowd. So obviously on the backside of a 360, you have to vector some energy towards the crowd, but the airplane has to be below 200 feet so that if there is some kind of an incident, they actually have in the regulations, they call it the scatter patterns of debris that, at the 1500 foot line at 200 feet, if the aircraft has a problem, it's going to hit the ground here and parts of the airplane aren't going to make it into the audience. I can tell you that one of the more famous crash scenes in aviation is the Tricolore crash in Germany. The Italian team, where one of the jets ended up in the crowd, and that maneuver would be strictly for prohibited anywhere in North America, U.S. or Canada.
Are those footsteps I hear?
Yeah, that's my fiance going back downstairs again. Sorry.
Get her some slippers. Right. No. Yeah. No. But Wendy, let's talk about air shows a little bit. And I'm going to let David and Rob jump in as well. But maybe you can kind of give us a sense for what does it take to put an air show together. I've got to believe this is an enormously complex undertaking and it involves probably more than the average spectator is aware.
Absolutely. One of the things that attracts me to running air shows is the complexity of it. I seem to be, in my personal life and professional life as well, I seem to be, she's walking back up the stairs now, but she's taking her shoes off.
Okay. Thank her for us.
So I would relate it to like getting an IFR rating. There's so much to learn and so much that has to be done. I saw the question on the pre-show here. One of the things that was going to come up is what does it take to put on an air show? And funny, the first thing that came to my mind, money.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere between, depending on the size of show, you need about between $25,000 and $100,000. That's one of the realities of the air show world is that your costs come out over a 12-month period and the lead up to the show, but all your revenue happens in one day. So you really have to be in a position, somebody's got to be in a position to finance that. The other big complexity is volunteers. We have hundreds, the Waterloo show that I co-produce is, we literally have between 200 and 300 trained volunteers doing everything from security to air operations and ground operations and vendors and transportation and the parking lots and ticket taking and all that. They're almost all volunteers. You need a good location. We're blessed in Waterloo with an airport where our spectator area faces the airplanes. The airplanes are north of the spectator area, so the sun is always on our spectators' backs, which makes it great. It's something you would never think of, but you know, the show runs along our main runway, which is 2608, and fortunately the crowd area is to the south, so we're facing to the north. Months and months and months of lead up working with regulators like Transport Canada, or in the US the FAA, NAV Canada, the military. You have to do marketing, you have to advertise a show, people have to know about it or they're not going to be able to come. And then you get into the what is really where I focus on the most is the performers. Just, I have a whole team of people whose sole function is to make sure that we know what the needs of the performers are before they get there, so we meet them, and that the performers know what our needs are before they get there so that they can meet ours. The you know, performer, every airplane is different, every performer is different. Some of them need Jet A, some of them need JP4, some of them need 100 low lead, some of them need different types of oil, Phillips 25 mineral oil for the old warbirds with big radials, all that stuff. You have to have it ready. If you don't have that stuff ready on Friday afternoon when they get there, you're going to have a big problem by Saturday afternoon when they can't fly anymore.
Is it difficult to find performers or not? I mean, are there more air shows or are there more performers?
On the civilian side, there are the performers that I know are some of the best salespeople I know. They stay in touch with me constantly, and I get regular emails from them wanting to know if they're going to be coming to perform in our show. They treat this as a business, and the more shows that they can perform in, the better. The more popular performers, you need to schedule them well in advance, because if you don't schedule them, somebody else is going to. There are my show this year is in Waterloo is June 1st and 2nd. The Rochester show is the same weekend, and the Rockford, Illinois show is the same weekend. So we need to make sure that we get the performers that we want booked early. On the military side, it's a whole different story. We are constantly lobbying the military with why they should be coming to our show, as opposed to somebody else's show, as opposed to taking a weekend off at the beginning of June. We're very fortunate in Waterloo that we're considered a major market and a major show for the Canadian forces. So our mainstays are always the snowbirds. We've been very fortunate to have them for the last 3 years, and we're on their schedule for the next out to 2014 now. And the CF-18, they only do their schedule in January, February for the coming year. But I've been given a wink that we've got a very good chance that we're going to have the CF-18 this year as well. So the military attending your show is, well, my business partner Richard and I sat down one day, and we're both very, very familiar with the snowbird team. He's actually an honorary snowbird. We know the crews, we know the team, we know quite a bit about operating jets of that size. Actually, my business partner, again, Richard, has a MiG-15 and an L-29, which are...
Oh, wow.
So we're pretty familiar with the cost of running jets.
Sure.
We tried to figure it out once, and of course, the military would never tell you this, and the Canadian government would never tell you this, but we figured probably somewhere around $300,000 to $350,000 is what the Canadian government spends to send the snowbirds to us for a weekend.
That's just for one air show, right?
That's for one show.
Yeah, for one show.
So as you can tell, a big part of my job is making sure that those guys are happy, that they get what they need out of the show from a recruiting standpoint, and that they're entertained and they don't have a lot of difficulties with coming to Waterloo and performing. I don't want them to have any reason to not come back.
Sure.
And what kind of numbers are you getting, David? I mean, in terms of, I guess if you were trying to do an analysis, say, cost per body that might show up to watch the show over that weekend?
Well, my budget in Waterloo, I'm fortunate in the layout and the cooperation I get from the region. My total budget is in the $400,000 range. That's what Richard and I spend to put the show on, and then what the military spends is over and above that. But our attendance, the last 2 years being the first two that Richard and I put on, we like to say that I like to put it this way. A typical air show in 10 years will have 8 good years of weather and 2 bad years of weather. Richard and I are very fortunate. We got the first 2 bad years of weather out of the way right away.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
our first year in 2011, there was a major tornado 50 miles from our airport, and it was on Sunday afternoon while the Snowbirds were performing. So you can imagine the weather for that weekend was rather tumultuous. It was, you know, thunderstorms in the area, constantly windy, and I ended up having to knock the Snowbirds off partway through their performance on the Sunday because of the tornado coming. And last year, it got truly abysmal. The temperatures, you guys will be familiar with Celsius, the temperatures were 13 degrees highs, winds were 25 to 30 knots, and it rained most of the weekend. So our attendance for the last 2 years has been 24,000 the year of the tornado and 5,000 the year of the rain and cold. The show site itself, its best year was 40,000 people. But I considered last year, actually, Richard and I talked at the end of the show and said, you know, we were trying to talk about whether or not this place actually warranted having an air show because we'd only had 5,000 people. My comment to Richard was that the two biggest air show fans I know are he and I, and neither of us would have gone that day.
Yeah.
And yet 5,000 people showed up. So, you know, you look at the overall budget and the overall costs. For the military, it's a question of being able to demonstrate to the public what they do day in and day out, demonstrate their skill, demonstrate their training, and demonstrate their equipment. We also put on a joint forces demo at our air show, which has some light armored vehicles, some infantry guys on the ground shooting blanks, and pyrotechnics. So we have bombs going off and simulated artillery strikes. And while that's going on, we have a couple of Griffin helicopters flying in aerial support. And then the Griffins pull away and a couple of F-18s come in and do simulated strafing runs and bomb drops, all with pyro, which, you know, it's great for the military. They get to show off what they do every day.
Sure.
David, got a question for you. This has always been a big bug for one of my closest friends. What's admission at Waterloo?
$25 for an adult. Children and seniors are 15. Veterans are free.
I'm kind of partial to the air show in that area that for long standing was one of the best air shows in North America, and that was London.
Yes.
You have the aspirations to get back to what that was since you're so close to that area?
I would love to be able to put on a show like London used to put on. The unfortunate thing is the military has cut back so heavily on their participation in air shows. Just last year, the Air Combat Command in the U.S. They had a Viper East and a Viper West demo team. They had a Strike Eagle team, and they had an A-10 East and A-10 West demo teams. And they grounded them all at the end of the 2011 season, which, I mean, that's five airplanes every weekend not doing air shows. Also, last year, there was a theme throughout the U.S. military at the National Guard and at the Air Force level and at the to a lesser extent at the Navy level that we don't have the budget to be sending you guys to go park airplanes at air shows anymore. So don't ask. You're not going to get approved. So the static participation or the airplanes parked on the ramp that you can go up and touch and feel from the U.S. has gone from, you know, the London days where they would have just about every imaginable piece of hardware available in the U.S. and Canadian inventory to almost nothing. That makes it very, very difficult to put on a show like London used to be.
Do you see that trend continuing? I mean, I do a lot of air shows. And truth be told, when I was 10 years old, I helped design an air show for my father because my father was base civil engineer at Willow Grove, and we had an air show. We had the Thunderbirds in. So I know all sorts of things like you have to have proper hotel rooms for each one of the Thunderbirds. You have to have a car for each one of them. And we used to have the Snowbirds all the time at the Grove. So I know what their requirements are.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I know what it's like going to these shows that there really isn't anything left to see on the lines. And I know that the demo teams are going away. Do you get a feeling that might ever change, that we might get critical mass and the Pentagon and the Canadian Armed Forces will figure out that they need to display to get recruiting?
Well, the Canadian Forces, fortunately for us, continues to support air shows at the same levels they've been supporting us for years. Last year at my show, I had a BAE Hawk from the Canadian Forces, a Harvard II, they call it a Gonzo, a Dash 8, We had a
Challenger. With the big nose.
Yeah, the one with the big nose. We had an Aurora, which is the equivalent of your Orion. I think they call it a P3.
P3, yep.
Yep. So we had a lot of hardware. Plus, I had two Hornets, both flying, and the Snowbirds. So the support I get from the Canadian forces and all the major shows in Canada get from the Canadian forces is still great. The U.S., you know, their official stand is that they're not they're trying to balance their budgets and trying to keep the correct amount of money being spent to entertain the public and to do recruiting efforts, and the correct amount of training money being spent on training so that the actual soldiers and airmen and pilots are trained properly when they have to go to war. Now, you know, the quiet thing you're not going to hear ever publicly stated is the Air Force isn't in the business of putting on air shows. They're in the business of fighting wars and defending their country. So right now, the Air Force is shedding pilots and shedding people, and they're, you know, I have a great many friends of mine who are regular forces, Air Force, who are now going down to part-time jobs in the reserves or, you know, being retired and that sort of thing. Until the Air Force, certainly the Air Force, anywhere in the military gets to the point where they have a higher demand for people than the number of people, I don't think you're going to see a lot of increase in recruiting efforts. The concern that raises for us, and where the International Council of Air Show comes in pitching to the U.S. military, is that your recruiting efforts at an air show aren't for a guy who's going to sign up this afternoon. You go talk to any pilot who's flying a fighter or a cargo plane or ground support aircraft or anything like that in the Air Force. Ask him the first time he decided he wanted to be a pilot.
And that would be that six-year-old little boy staring at a red, white, and blue F-4J. That would be me. I don't think the Air Force has ever figured out their target market.
I think they know that. It's very difficult in a political situation. And let's face it, when you get into the high-ranking officials in the military, they're politicians as much as they are soldiers. It's very difficult for a politician to spend money for something that's going to happen in 20 and 30 years. So they are doing it. I mean, they still have a Raptor demo team out there. We still have a Heritage Flight program where if I hire the right group of people with a P-51 Mustang, for example, the Air Force may send me an F-16 and they'll do some formation flying around to do what's called a Heritage Flight, which I'm sure, David, you're familiar with. Yeah. And they still try and support shows with flybys and with as much static as they can possibly do. But at the end of the day, if it costs them a training flight and a Strike Eagle, they're not going to send it to an air show. They're going to do the training flight.
Follow-on question. Suddenly we see a rise of civilian jet teams. Do you see that trend continuing?
There's certainly a demand for it because of the cutbacks that the military has executed. It's now, well, you know, now I'm an air show that's in a small market or a mid-sized market in the U.S., and I'm not high profile enough that I'm going to get an F-22 demo or the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds. Well, now I've got another option. Those teams are very good. I actually know quite a few of the pilots on both teams. One of the big problems with them is the fuel cost for the air show. Military guys pay for their own gas. Putting, you know, look at the heavy metal jet team last year, for example. I was at Oceana and watched them perform with two MiG-17s and four L-39s. I wouldn't even want to guess how much the fuel budget for that was for the weekend. So Oceana's got it pretty good because it's a military base and their, you know, their operational budget covers off their fuel costs. For a show like mine in Waterloo, I'd probably be looking at a $80,000 or $100,000 fuel bill. So that makes it difficult. I heard a rumor, and it was just a rumor, at the end of last year that the heavy metal team is not going to continue operations into this year. They had bought their two MiG-17s are up for sale on controller.com, I saw, and they've bought some single-engine jet aircraft they're going to be using as adversary training for the Navy. One of the primary principals in that group is Dale Snodgrass, yeah. And if anybody was going to get a contract or provide adversary for the U.S. Navy, it'd be Snort, because he's done an awful lot of it himself when he was working for the Navy. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that one go away. The Patriot team out of California, I know, is going strong. I was just meeting with them or talking to them in ICAST. A very good friend of mine, ex-Snowbird team lead, is flying for them. And there's an ex-Thunderbird team lead that I know, Wilbur, who flies for them as well. So do I see that increasing? Not really, because of the fact that it's such an expensive game to play. You know, buying five or six trainers or L-39s or L-29s or MiGs or anything else is a pretty pricey piece of equipment to get a hold of and start operating. And finding air shows that have the budget to put gas in them is a difficulty as well. So I see a niche for it. I don't see it becoming the next big thing. They're never going to be doing 30 shows a year, I don't think.
Interesting. Let's talk about the Council of Air Shows a little bit. And maybe you can explain, who are the people that produce air shows? I mean, are they individuals? Are they companies? Who are the producers? And I assume that's the membership of the council?
That and performers and support organizations. So who are the producers of air shows? Sometimes it's a city that owns an airport. Sometimes it's a private company that just wants to produce an air show. Sometimes it's, in my case, it's Richard and I are, you know, your podcast is called Airplane Geeks. Well, we fit that description perfectly. we're both private company. We both own our own companies, and which allows us a little bit of time flexibility to do what we want with our time, and allows us some financial flexibility to be able to take the kind of risks that you have to take to be able to put the show on. And we both love aviation.
Yeah, that's clear. That's great. And so what's the mission of the council?
I was kind of going over that in my head this afternoon, and I thought, really, is there a single statement that ties up what ICAST does? And I can't say that there is. In one sense, they're a regulator. And I shouldn't say the word regulator because it's not entirely accurate, but ICAST runs a program called the AACE program, and that stands for Aerobatic Competency Evaluators. And they have a group of performers who are, I guess you'd say, accredited experts in their fields. And they can go around. If I'm a new performer and I want to go start flying in air shows, if I want to do aerobatics, I have to have a statement of aerobatic competency. And it's a card. It's called a SAC card. In order to get a statement of aerobatic competency, an ICAST ACE evaluator has to sit down with me and evaluate me and certify that I'm safe to be able to do the kind of maneuvers that I'm signed to do. And he signs me off on a particular type of aircraft or multiple aircraft. And at the beginning, I'm limited to 800 feet or 500 feet or 250 feet or to the surface. And there's a very specific set of regulations that allow me to work my way down to what's called a surface waiver. A group within ICAST manages that process. So that's a huge thing that ICAST does. The other thing we do is we represent the air show producers, performers, and in general, the membership of ICAST to regulators like the FAA and Transport Canada and the NTSB. They speak on our behalf. When the Reno incident happened last year, and there were very quickly there were hearings, Senate hearings into the industry, and our president and chair both went, and some members of our board of ICAST went and spoke to Senate about and what safety precautions we take and how safety has improved in the air show business over the years. So that's another thing it does. They put on the ICAST convention every year where 1,300 to 1,500 performers, pilots, producers, and service providers all get together in Vegas for a week. They put on training programs, and they have a gala dinner, and we have the ICAST bar, which is where a lot of the business gets done, as a lot of you guys can understand being in the aviation world. Sure. So in a nutshell, ICAST's function is to represent its membership and also to influence its membership. I'm constantly getting there's a guy that works for ICAST, and his job is to improve safety at air shows. Full stop. That's all he's supposed to be doing. I get an email from him about once every 2 weeks. It's called the Ops Bulletin, and it goes over things that we're doing and things that are being suggested to improve safety. things that have happened where, you know, hey, did you know that, this happened and they weren't prepared for it? Cousin, are you prepared for that? ICAST puts on some wonderful training programs. I couldn't begin to tell you the things I've learned there. And we also, they have a safety stand down every year for air bosses and for performers, where we sit down and say, okay, here's the things that were done wrong over the last year. Let's avoid those going forward. Make sure that everybody's aware of, you know, trying to learn from other people's mistakes, basically.
Right.
You know, one of the things we were talking about this year at the convention is there is currently no certification for air bosses. Any person with a birth certificate can stand up and call themselves an air boss. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to get, in the U.S., it's called a waiver from FAA, and in Canada, it's called a special flight operations certificate. Obviously, transport or the FAA have to have some comfort level that the air boss knows what they're doing, but there's no license for it. There's no, not like the ACE program where there's a statement of aerobatic competency. So one of the things we're working very hard on right now is a certification program for air bosses, how to do it.
Maybe you can just sort of describe the responsibilities of an air boss for those who might not be familiar.
There are some differences between air bosses in Canada and the U.S., but all the similarities are, in Canada, we call it transport calls it a director of flight operations. So some of it is a bit show dependent. I'll speak to it mostly from my own experience. I book the performers. I apply for the waiver or SFOC, the Special Flight Operations Certificate with transport. I liaise with the military. I choreograph the acts. I put together the schedule to say which acts go at which point during the show, trying to make it so that I don't have people falling asleep for half the day and, you know, can't handle the excitement for the other half.
Yeah.
I have to put on what's called a pilot safety briefing every morning before there's a show. And in that pilot safety briefing, I go through the field, how it looks like, what the various lines are. You know, there's a 500-foot line, which is for what they call Cat 3 aircraft or small piston planes, that's 500 feet from the crowd line. And then there's the 1,000-foot crowd line, which would be typically warbirds, P-40s, P-51s, that kind of thing. And that speed range, you have to be 1,000 feet out. And then there's the big guys on the 1,500-foot line. You know, if you're flying an F-18 or a MiG-15 or something like that, you're going to be out on the 1,500-foot line. So I go through pictures and maps and show people how they're going to tell which of those lines is which, how they're going to identify them. There's corner markers. You know, we've all seen an airplane do a banana pass at an air show where it comes from left to right or right to left in a turn. There are actually markers that they can't come inside when they're doing that maneuver to make sure that they don't fly over the crowd. I go through that. I go through anything special, talk in the air show, talk about weather. Weather's a big deal. I mean, weather has caused a lot of incidents in the air show world, especially density altitude. Density altitude and haze are probably the two biggest gotchas in the air show world. So I do a pilot safety briefing. I'm the guy on the radio coordinating the airplane, so I'm telling you, you know, I tell the snowbirds, the airspace is yours, the field is yours. Taxi your discretion, take off your discretion, and then I'm there on the radio talking to, in my case, NAV Canada, making sure that there's no aircraft intrusions into the airspace. The snowbirds, for example, have a 7-mile in radius circle and about 7,000 feet in altitude. So NAV Canada is constantly monitoring that for me, and if they have an intrusion into that airspace, they'll let me know. In Canada, I also have to confirm that all the performers are conforming with the CAR. I have to review that they've got a valid certificate of airworthiness, certificate of registration, certificate of insurance, pilot's license, including the type rating, current medical, statement of aerobatic competency if they're going to be doing aerobatics. And I have to go through, each one of them has to provide me a maneuvers package, which details basically pass by pass exactly what they're going to do. And I have to go through that line by line and make sure that everything they're going to do is legal and it's safe and it makes sense and they're doing it on the correct line and it all works. So I have an agreement with the performer as to what they're going to do. And I have an expectation when they're performing that they're going to stick to that maneuvers package. I contract performers and I lobby the military to come to the air shows that I'm representing.
Wow, that's amazing.
I mean, in a nutshell.
If someone is interested in producing an air show. I mean, you just can't, you know, walk into the room and say, hey, I've got a great idea. I'm going to produce an air show. How did you come to understand all of these requirements and the responsibilities that you would have to do this?
I got into this originally because I had a boat many, many years ago. And this is an old Toronto air show story. I had a boat, and every year I had a couple of friends who volunteered for the Toronto Air Show. One of them was the air boss, and they always wanted me to come to the show. And I said, no, I was Labor Day weekend. I'm on my boat. Well, I sold my boat. And then I went to this guy's house one night, and I got, you know, we got into a few cocktails, as pilots will. And the next thing I knew, I was the air operations manager. So it was trial by fire. I had a lot of guidance in the beginning and a lot of people helping me out that had a lot of experience and a lot of understanding. And I love big education program process and learning that. Go to ICAS. I took the AirBoss 101 program. I took the AirBoss 201 program. I read the Section 623 of the CARS. That's how I got into it. And eventually I got to the point where I was competent enough to airboss a show. And you know, I still remember that first show and the lead up to it. The stress level was unbelievable, but I learned a lot. I continue to learn a lot. You know, last year I had my first civilian helicopter act at an air show, and I had to learn a whole new section of the CARS relating to what helicopters are allowed and what they're not allowed to do. So, you know, I think the question was, how do you, if you wanted to get into the air show business, if you wanted to start an air show, how would you do it? My advice to anybody would be start going to ICAS, sign up for every class that you can possibly sign up for to learn as much as you can, and start volunteering for a show. Hmm. Find a show in your area that you think you could get along with and call them up and say, hey, I want to learn about this and I want to come out and volunteer. That's sure. How you're going to learn.
Now, you've got a kind of an interesting aircraft of your own, and you've flown in some interesting old airplanes, I think.
I have, actually. I have a Cessna Cardinal RG, and it's what makes it more interesting than anything is the fact that its call sign is SIN, so it's Cardinal Sin.
That's great.
U.S. air traffic control. Canadian air traffic controllers don't seem to think that's very funny, but the Americans always do. Whenever I fly in the U.S., I'll be talking to a controller for a few minutes, and all of a sudden they'll say, hey, wait a minute, did you ask for that call sign? Yeah, I love my Cardinal. I've had it for many years, and just like anybody else with an airplane, they know it's a constant hole into the air in which you throw lots of money. But and I have flown it a lot. I've put about 1,200 hours on it in the last 5 years, I guess. One of my greatest experience I ever had in my life was I have a very good friend, Curtis Arnold, who came to me one day, and we were approaching the 100th anniversary of powered flight in Canada, which was in 2009. And Curtis is, he works for Nav Canada, and my friends and I refer to him as the brain because he knows everything there is to know about aviation. And I'm not exaggerating. If you have any question, just ask Curtis, he'll know. He actually is one of the hosts on a program called The Aviators. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, TV. Yeah, sure. Yes.
He's one of the hosts of that show. Anyway, he had this 1942 Tiger Moth, open cockpit. And he said to me that he had been approached to fly, to join this across Canada flight to celebrate the 100th anniversary of powered flight in Canada. would I like to sit in the other seat? No, yes.
Yeah.
Think about that for very long. And I said, can you imagine sitting with your grandparents, grandchildren, and telling them you had a chance to fly an open cockpit Tiger Moth across the country? And you said no.
That's right. Yeah.
So we spent, it was 20 flight legs each way. The plane flies, it takes off at 65 miles an hour, it cruises at 70, and it lands at 65 and goes about 2.5 hours on a tank of fuel.
Wow. What an adventure, though. That sounds really cool.
It was unbelievable. I can't count the number of times I hand-propped the airplane in the run of a week and a half because it has no starter. The people ask me what it's like to fly. I said it's like standing on a basketball. You know, in my Cardinal, if I was to let go of the controls and turn around for 30 seconds and talk to the person in the back seat, if I look back up, I'm sure it'd be doing pretty much exactly what I left it at. Hmm. If you let the controls in the Tiger Moth, in about 5 seconds, you'd be in an inverted dive. and we had to pack, you know, luggage for 2 weeks in, you know, the tiniest little cargo compartment. And there were areas where we had to fly through the U.S. because in Canada, the airports are too far apart. The airplane doesn't have long enough legs to get from one. It only goes 140 miles before you have to stop. That was one of my probably the highlights of my life was doing that.
Yeah, that sounds great. What an opportunity! Yeah, that any of us would love to take. Can you tell us about the upcoming air shows? The calendar for 2013, and where our listeners who might be interested in attending can learn more about the show.
The biggest thing I would suggest for anybody who wants to go to an air show and isn't familiar, doesn't know firsthand one that's in your area, is the ICAS website. And they have a complete listing there of every air show in North America. And you don't have to be a member of ICAS to put your show on their schedule, but most of the shows are members. You know, you can pick any month you want or any region you want and go find an air show in your area. Firsthand, I mean, my own air show schedule this year starts out with my own show, June 1st and 2nd in Waterloo. A couple of weeks after that, I'm in Bagotville, Quebec, which is Canada. We have two bases where we base our CF-18 fighters. One of them is in Bagotville, and the Bagotville show is one I go to every other year. So having a show every other year. And I'll be at, actually, my month of July kind of got messed up this year because the Thunderbirds are leaving for Europe, and some of the shows that I would normally go to, like Rochester and Thunder over Michigan and near Detroit and Ypsilanti, are conflicting with my own show, so I'm not able to go to those ones. But I also do Oceania and Rhode Island are some of my favorites. Thunder over Michigan is a great show. It's going to be in the middle of June this year. And then there's the whole rest of the country. I mean, that's just this little pocket in the Northeast.
Sure.
We had a pretty significant decline in the number of air shows, certainly in Canada, and I think the same thing happened in the U.S. about 8 or 10 years ago. And there, during in the 2009 was the 100th anniversary in Canada. There was a big resurgence of air shows, and it seems to be holding steady. There's not a big decline happening anymore in shows, and attendance at shows, according to ICAST numbers, is continuing to climb. Hmm. People see it as a great value. You know, take a family of four to a football game or a baseball game, and you're going to spend probably close to $1,000 by the time you're done. You know, tickets for a professional sporting event are, you know, can be $50 to $100 per person.
Oh, sure, easily.
Yeah, I mean, you can take five people to the Waterloo Air Show for under $100.
And the Waterloo Air Show is on Twitter.
Twitter and Facebook, and I actually have a good friend of mine, Diana Spremo, she's actually the person who I believe you spoke to arrange this. She looks after all of our marketing and advertising and social media. Unfortunately, telling you that we're on Facebook and Twitter is about the limit of my knowledge of.
Okay. David White, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating. I mean, as I said before, you know, we're all, and our listeners, I think, are great fans of air shows, and it's kind of nice to have a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, as it were, to see some of the things that it takes to be a producer and some of the things that you go through in order to give us such a great show. So, again, thank you.
Well, my pleasure, and I'll hang on for the rest of the program. That way I don't have to listen to it after I download it.
Okay. All right. Very good. And now here's David Vanderhoof.
Thanks, Max. Well, it's that time of year again. And for all of you who know me, I got to do something for Christmas. So curl up underneath the Christmas tree or find some cozy place to listen to this podcast, because tonight we're going to read the equivalent of a Christmas bedtime story. It's the Airplane Geek Story of the Week. It was December 24th, 1954. It was going to be another mission that no one would know about. Okay, if there was a name for the middle of nowhere, it was the U.S. Air Force Base in Chimaya. It's a 10,000-foot runway dominating feature of this 2-mile by 4-mile rock at the end of the Aleutian Islands. The place was built to launch B-29s to bomb Japan. The wooden buildings we slept in were cold. The mess hall was cold. Ops was cold. The place would have made a polar bear get a chill. My name, Captain Mel Chior. My second was Major Casper Ghost Smith. And down in the hole was Major Bal Baltic Salzar. Tonight was the night we were going to be getting off the rock. We were going to ferry our RB-47H back to Japan. 53-42-91 was a good ship. She never let us down. Normally, down in the bay, we would have had three other operators, but since this was a long-range ferry, we didn't want the burden. However, we did have one passenger. The wing commander asked if senior airman Jose Garces could fly with us to Japan. Garces' wife was with child and in Japan was due soon, so we would carry him to Japan. I flew B-24s in the war over Europe. If he ever told me I would be flying a ship twice as fast, I would have said, yeah, right. Our mission, like I said, was to fly our aircraft to Japan. We wouldn't be going anyplace near where we would be shot for once, just vast ocean and a mid-air refueling. That still takes my breath away. Then cocktails. Real scotch. 8 weeks on that rock and we could finally get that golden beverage. Christmas had already started in Japan, but I didn't care. This bachelor wanted warmth. Our flight plan was filed for 12:25 takeoff. Ops thought that was funny. 3 hours later, we were hooked up with the KC-135 to get our tanks filled in with eggnog and real food and warmth. Oh, and to make sure that airman got to the hospital on time. As it became increasingly clear that our visibility wasn't getting any better, weather said we had a small window around 1400 that we might make it out. I said, I'll take it. Pre-planning, refiling, I hate paperwork. I just want to fly. It became clear that out our window that the tanker track would be getting tighter. Nothing beyond normal, but just tighter. So in the jet at 1300 pre-flight and the weather ain't getting any better. Finally, after sitting in that cockpit with the heater doing its best to prevent me from getting frostbite, Ghost called up to me and said, it's time to go. It's now 1420. Damn. Okay, fast taxi on the 1028 and away we go. Tower, this is Prancer 4. How do you read? Did I mention Ops had a sense of humor? I personally wasn't amused. Prancer 4, this is Tower. You're cleared for takeoff. Safe flight and Merry Christmas. Prancer 4, copy. Cleared for takeoff. I slowly pushed the throttles forward. Three-quarter time made her usual grunts and groans, and I started to make her music. Oh, I forgot that, didn't I? 4291 was named three-quarter time. My commander back in the war had two names for our plane. Originally, it was Camel, because we flew the hump. Eventually, we found out the old man was a great swing drummer. Suddenly, the plane had a different name, Little Drummer Boy in Three-Quarter Time. We always were so lucky. So I kept the three-quarter time. So we had five engines humming. Number three wasn't just not right. Called back to Ghost. So what do you think? I think we're good, Captain. I'll keep an eye on it. Baltic, we good to go? Check, boss, came through the radio system. So even though number three worried me, I pushed the throttle forward and we started rolling down bumpy runway 10. The bumps always seemed to be worse taking off in this direction. I knew I needed lots of runway as we crossed the 8,000-foot mark. I started to worry. 9,000-foot. Come on, baby. Let's get this waltz started. Three-quarter time heard me, and off we went. Merry Christmas, Tower. Prancer 4 out. As we climbed altitude, the weather wasn't getting better, and the climb was still really uneven. Casper, remind me to throttle that crew. I told him about that number 3 last week. Mel, it's Christmas. Cut him a break, responded Ghost. Then I remembered down where there was supposed to be bombs was a cold, nervous wreck of an airman. I keyed the mic. Jose, how you doing down there? After a moment's voice came from below. Fine, sir. It's really dark down here, sir. No problem, airman. I'll send the flight attendant back with hot chocolate. Baltic, you heard the man. Get that soon-to-be father a blanket. I could tell Baltic was concentrating too hard. The intercom replied, will do, sir. I switched over to just Baltic. Okay, what's up? Sir, the weather is getting ugly. I did some recalculations and we will be cutting really close for that tanker. I started to get a little worried, but no worries, Balt. We'll get there. We were 2.5 hours late. Casper called Yokota about our 135. Well, we had lost our first track, but we could catch another 135 that was supporting SAC initiatives. They were diverting to meet us halfway. I might get that scotch yet. The smell of incense suddenly wafted into my nose. Scotch. And that bar, what was that bar's name I was going to? It was another minute, 30 minutes later, that all hell broke loose. Bang! What the hell was that? Well, I'm pretty sure that isn't what I said, but you get the point. Casper said, we lost three and it took out number two. I suddenly found myself flying with a lot of rudder. One engine on one side, three on the other. I began emergency procedures and started to shut down two and three. We were in luck. The failure had caused the pod to break free, so we were not on fire, but we were leaking fuel badly. I knew the answer, but I radioed down to Baltic. So we had a little Christmas cracker surprise up here. Baltic, got a place for us to go quick? I'm already on it, sir. I could tell Baltic was none too happy. Casper, get Yakota on the phone. Find out if there are any Navy down there. He was already on it. Prince 40 Yakota. Prince 40 Yakota. Come in, Yakota. Mayday. Yakota, control to Prancer 4, state your emergency. Casper continued on, and I, for some reason, drifted off for a second. Then I realized down in the hold there, there was some scared kid. I keyed the mic. Airman, you okay down there? I'm fine, sir. Everything okay? A very terrified voice. A pause. Sir? I retorted, up here, we're none too formal. Call me Mel. Okay, Jose? Yes, sir. I mean, Mel, sir. I smiled. Well, Jose, we hit a little bump in the road, but I promise you, you'll get to see your wife. Why the heck did I say that? There's no way we're ever getting to Japan. We'll be lucky if we're picked up at sea. Casper called down the ball and asked our location. Ball replied, all my gauges are doing nutty things. With this cloud cover, I can't even take a star sight. Okay, keep us posted. The next 40 minutes flew by. We weren't going to make anchor. I really didn't know where we were. I had made a stupid promise to some kid below. If we ditched, there was a good chance he wouldn't make it. And if we were parachuting out of Bombay, wasn't really recommended. I radioed it back to Casper. Any news? No, sir. His voice was very somber. Baltic, 20 minutes of flight time, and I have nowhere idea where the hell we are, sir. Well, that's that. I started my descent. We were going to have to ditch or jump. Neither option seemed at all pleasant. For some reason, I keyed the mic and started singing Silent Night, Holy Night. All is calm, all is bright. Sir? A quiet voice came from below. Yeah, Jose. Have we begun our descent? Yes. Damn, I made that boy a promise. I never break a promise. Sir? You will tell me when to bail out. He knew. What was I thinking? Of course he knew. I was a fool. Jose, I will tell you, I promise. God, please let me keep that one, please. Baltic suddenly shouted, I see a star. I see the North Star. Coordinates coming. Mel, I looked up and there was a break in the clouds, and yes, there was a star. Funny, though, as I looked back, the star was a heck of a lot brighter than the North Star. I never could shoot stars because I could never find that thing, son of a bitch. Baltic sent up the cast from Radio Dakota. Well, if we were going to ditch now, at least someone would know where to send the boat. Then the radio crackled. Prancer 4, come in. Prancer 4, come in. Cookie 2 to Prancer 4. Understand you have a little problem. You ain't got enough milk. Strange accent. I keyed. Cookie 2, so got any of that milk? We got a bad hole in our cup. Don't want Santa to miss out, so what brings you out this time of night? Well, we heard the call to Yakota and we divert to you. Rudy, our boomer, has you in our sights. Turn right 15 degrees towards and head towards the red lights. Right, 15 degrees. I eased off the rudder and the girl made a gentle turn. I caressed the yoke. This is going to be fun. Air to air during the day is hard. Air to air at night is a bear. Air to air missing two engines at night, well, I eased up to the boom. Rudy guided us in contact. I radioed, evening, fill it. Can you wash the windows? Rudy radios back. Yes, sir. And I'll put air in your tires also. One hell of an one horse open sleigh there, sir. Copy that. Prancer 4, it looks like you need a little help finding your way home. I radioed. Indeed, I have a package that needs to be delivered to Japan. Santa seems to have left in Alaska by accident. Roger that. Suddenly, we were going to make it. That KC-135 was towing us home. We unplugged. Rudy, sir, I have eyes on you. Keep in formation and follow us. Roger. An hour later, we were over Yokota. I was exhausted. Casper and Baltic were also. Bobtail called to me. Prancer 4, you're on final. Yokota, we're breaking off and we'll circle and come in after you. We landed. The worst one I have ever done. We rolled out. I threw back the canopy, took a deep breath. The fire trucks looked very festive this night with their red gumdrops ablazing. I met Casper and Bala on the ground. Out of the hold came Jose, quite look peaked. He ran up to me and gave me the crispest of salutes. I didn't return it. I just wrapped around my arms and wished him a Merry Christmas. Now get your ass in gear and go see your wife. Yes, sir. Airman, what's your wife's name? Maria, sir. Call me Mel. Stop calling me sir. Now get going. Off he ran. He did get to the hospital on time. They had a baby boy. His name, Melvin. That poor kid. Strangest thing, though, that night, that KC-135 never did land. I thought it diverted to another field, but I could never find that crew, nor a boomer named Rudy. I guess it was just not my time. Though following a star, then Rudy, every Christmas Eve, I pray to this day. Thank you for letting me keep my promise. And thanks to all those men and women who are watching over us. Keep them safe this Christmas and bring them home next year. Now, where's my scotch? Merry Christmas.
Great story, David.
David, you always come up with something.
I try.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 16th, 2012.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 228. Well, Grant, this week we're going to kick it off by starting with defence. That's probably the big news this week. Now, in a recent episode of Playing Crazy Down Under, we were chatting with well-respected aviation and defence journalist Andrew McLaughlin, and one of the questions I raised with him surrounded Australia's fleet of 24 F-18F Super Hornets. Now, yes, David, we know that's not very many, but I asked Andrew, did he think that was enough? And he had some very interesting views on whether or not they would be sufficient. Should push come to shove, well, maybe they were listening to us, Grant, because the Australian government this week has sent a letter of request to the US government, maybe just inquiring about buying a few more.
That's right, mate. They've asked for availability and pricing information for another 24 Super Hornets. And I think it's probably going to be required because, let's face it, the F-35 just keeps getting delayed. This government's probably going to push out any commitment to spend any more on it as far as they can because they're trying to balance the budget and or bring in a surplus, whatever your political views. I'll leave it up to you to decide on that in this global environment, whether that's a good idea, but they're going to push back any spending is my prediction. And as such, we're going to wind up with an even greater gap that we have to bridge and fewer aircraft to do it as more and more of the F-18 classic aircraft reach their time life and have to be retired. So yeah, you can see some logic in it. It's copping a lot of flack though, because some people are saying it's a very expensive lack of decision. Look, I don't know. I'm still waiting to see that the F-35 really does what everyone's thinking it's going to do. There's some potential in there, but there's a lot of issues to resolve. And the way that project has been set up and managed has made it almost impossible to resolve all of them before people have to commit a lot of money, which is why you're seeing a lot of countries trying to avoid committing money, like Australia's probably going to do.
Absolutely. Now, it's interesting, of course, that they put out this letter of request, and that makes it sound like an announcement. A rather scathing article, actually, in Australian Aviation magazine this week actually calls the announcement by Defence Minister Stephen Smith as an announcement about nothing.
Yeah, they called it a faux announcement, if I recall correctly.
A faux announcement indeed. Now, of course, it would be interesting if we did go for these Super Hornets. Of course, Australia took delivery of the fleet of Super Hornets while the Labor government has been in power. But interestingly, those aircraft were actually ordered by the previous coalition Conservative government. Now, in an odd twist, if they were to order these aircraft now, and this government, the way it's tracking, almost certainly won't be in power by the time these aircraft are delivered. So it's all just a pendulum swinging backwards and forwards. But the interesting thing is here, they're making an announcement, but there's no funding for these aircraft at the moment, and where are they going to get that money from? Stephen Smith has also been called, we're hearing this increasingly, is actually being called the Minister for Disarmament rather than the the Minister for Defence. And the way they've cut back the military to pay for some of their spending on other projects around the nation, it's quite disturbing, and a lot of military people are not happy about it.
Oh, man, I did wonder where some of those ex-New Zealand government members went, the ones who butchered the Kiwi Air Force. Maybe they're consulting to the Australian government now.
Maybe, mate, maybe indeed. If they bring this decision in to bring in more Super Hornets, you know, really those aircraft have a different role to the aircraft that the F-35 are meant to replace. As you mentioned, Grant, that's the classic Hornets. Now, those older FA-18A and B Hornets have been around since the mid-80s. They're getting on, and, you know, there's all sorts of issues around airframe fatigue, cracking, and all that sort of stuff, particularly to do with the center barrel area of those aircraft. So they're really getting towards the end of their life. So even if we do bring in these extra Super Hornets, you know, they're still going to have to either bring that F-35 on, or failing that, they're going to have to find something else to replace those older Hornets, or the capability gap that we've already been experiencing since the F-111s went, that's only going to get exponentially worse. Okay, Grant, moving across into the airlines this week, and Virgin Australia's had a couple of new stories pop up. Now, we've been talking a lot this year about Virgin building closer ties with other airlines, and most notably, I guess, amongst those would be Air New Zealand, and it looks like Air New Zealand is building even closer ties with Virgin Australia, according to this article by Steve Creedy in The Australian this week.
Yeah, that's right, mate. You've got the incoming CEO, Christopher Luxon, who's going to replace Rob Fyfe at the end of the year. And yeah, he's continuing to work to build the brand image of Air New Zealand within Australia and get those ties even closer with Virgin Australia. They're probably not going to get on the board, is what they're saying, but you know, they're trying to make sure that there's a way better lockstep between their processes, their aircraft, sharing passengers and so on, to help really prop each other up on the Trans-Tasman especially.
Christopher Luxon already saying all the right things that are loved in the business world. I'm just looking through this report here, Grant, and I see words like synergies. We always like it when they say synergies. So that probably means a few people are going to lose their jobs, I guess, but down at the coalface.
Well, I guess we'll see about that, Steve. But interestingly, somebody that's probably not going to be losing their job will be the folks working at Tourism Australia, because as we reported previously, Qantas were looking at no longer putting up to about $44 million into Tourism Australia, and Virgin Airlines stepped forward. Well, that stepping forward has actually brought some money through, and they're going to double their contribution to Tourism Australia to partially help fill the gap left by Qantas.
Yes, and interestingly there, I noticed in this article here that the Tourism Australia board is still backing Jeff Dixon, who of course is the former boss of Qantas. So lots and lots of politics going on there. And as I said the other week, I don't think Tourism Australia itself is going to suffer from Qantas pulling that $44 million out, not when you've got other airlines ready to step in and fill the financial gap like that. Now, speaking of Virgin, while they're in the news this week, and they've had a few stories this week, the other one surrounds their pending or possible relocation from Brisbane, where they are currently, down to Sydney. Now, that's very interesting because when they went to set up here, and there was a big fight on at the time when they set up in Brisbane, because I know there was a huge push to have them settle down here in Melbourne, and much disappointment when they didn't.
That's right, mate. They cited Brisbane as being a better environment for their staff, and they got some pretty good deals from the Queensland government and Brisbane Airport to base their various operations there and their headquarters. The rumour is that they're going to come back down to Sydney. I've heard some conflicting rumours saying no, they're not going to do that, and the Queensland government is definitely leaping to the fore to try and prevent it from happening, and looking at ways that they can entice Virgin to not think about going down to Sydney, which does, of course, raise the question of, could this be one of those telegraph punches to try and get a better deal or extend the current deal in Queensland, perhaps?
Yeah, well, why not? You might as well leverage your government. And, of course, the government up there run by Campbell Newman and his conservatives up there are not really popular at the moment. They're making lots of big cutbacks. So I'm sure they'd be pretty keen not to lose the Virgin Australia headquarters. So, they may be just scrambling to make sure that that move down to Sydney doesn't happen.
Indeed, mate, indeed.
Now, one more this week, and we talk a lot about Qantas, but let's do a little bit of nerdy plane spotting stuff, Grant. According to this article here in australianaviation.com.au, the beginning of the end for the Rolls-Royce-powered Qantas 767s as Zulu X-Ray Bravo heads to New Mexico for storage.
It's going to be stored where the aliens are, at Roswell, and it's the first of the Rolls-Royce-powered ones, isn't it, mate?
It is, in fact. Now, okay, everybody get their ashtray thickeners glasses on, I'm going to run through a few nerdy facts here. Now, this aircraft.
Oh, Grant, hang on. I haven't got my Parker on. Hang on, my anorak. Sit there with my notepad.
I always find this stuff interesting. Anyway, this is one of seven, actually, ex-British Airways aircraft. It's actually a Dash 336. And, of course, Qantas aircraft are all Dash something 38. So this is a 767-336ER. It's construction number 24338. And it actually was delivered in May 1990, actually, to British Airways. Spent 10 years with them and came here to Australia in 2000 and has been here in Qantas colours ever since. So quite an old airframe, and it's powered by Rolls-Royce engines. Qantas ended up taking in seven of those aircraft into their fleet of 24. And for the plane spotters there, and we know a lot of them like to sit around Sydney Harbour there watching them come in and out, any of those ones that start with VH-Zulu or ZX something, they're all the ex-British Airways ones. So it looks like we won't be seeing them around our skies for much longer, although some of the younger airframes have only recently been refurbished, at least on the inside, so I guess they'll be around for a few more years. Well, they haven't got anything to replace them with right now, so I guess they'll have to stay.
That's right, mate. That's right. But as they get rid of these Rolls-Royce ones and just focus on their younger GE ones, they certainly got their mileage out of those 767s, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. So great 12 years of service here in Australia and 22 years for that aircraft. And I guess for those of you who are Australian listeners and wanting to get out there with your long lenses, well, you better start doing it if you want the Zulu Series ones, because the retirement program has been enacted.
That's it, mate. The beginning of the end.
Oh, there you go. See, a little bit of airplane geekery for the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, having done the airplane geekery, we can now go back to pronunciation 101. Hi, Rob.
You'll hurt his self-esteem if we keep picking on him like that, Grant.
Well, he says we hate kangaroos. We don't. I love them. They taste delicious.
I might even have a kangaroo pie for lunch.
Oh, there you go.
Just stop it hopping around the plate. Anyway, someone who's probably never eaten a kangaroo pie in his entire life is Peter Johnson, and we welcome him this week as he presents the 100th edition of Across the Pond. Congratulations, Peter.
Woohoo!
Welcome to the 100th Across the Pond segment. What an aeroplane ride it's been. Thank you so much for all the listener support we've been given. It seems you really like the historic stuff we've been producing for you. We have in fact brought a whole raft of guests to you in the last 100 segments, and now have regular updates from Spain, Holland, India, Ireland, Switzerland, and most recently the Middle East. We also have new regional contributors coming to us from South Africa and Italy as well. We're also planning a few more mini-series for you. Our Christmas special will come out with an amazing episode on a museum that has some very special aviation artifacts, so listen out for that. Back to the 100th segment then. I thought we'd focus the segment on the number 100 and what this means to aviation, and I invited back some of our guests in the past few years to tell us what the number 100 means to them. We start with editor of Global Aviation Resource, my co-host on Extended, Gareth Stringer.
Hi guys, it's Gareth from Extended and GlobalAviationResource.com. Wow, 100 segments. What a fantastic achievement. Well done to you all. What does 100 mean to me? It means 100 Squadron, Royal Air Force here in the UK. What an amazing unit. They've operated the FE-2B, the Avro Lancaster, the English Electric Canberra. Now they're our version of the aggressors flying the BAE Systems Hawk. Well done to you all, and thanks for all your support. Keep it up.
Thank you, Gareth. And what does 100 mean from our Spanish contributor, Diego?
Hello, I'm Diego López Salazar from the Spanish Aeropodcast. And the number 100 in aviation terms is important to me, as the A380 number 100 in production will be delivered soon. Thai Airways will be the airline receiving the plane, and I'll be glad to receive an invitation to the event in Toulouse. Cheers.
Thanks so much, Diego.
And so, to the folks at Aviation Platform.
Hello everyone, this is Ashwant.
And Stephen from aviationplatform.com.
The number 100 to Aviation Platform means 100 years of sharing aviation knowledge, 100 years of inspiring people with aviation.
To reach more than 100 people every day with interesting aviation blogs. And lastly, to share aviation knowledge 100 years more.
Thank you for having us on the show.
And we hope to welcome you soon on our website aviationplatform.com.
Thank you very much, guys, for that, all the way from Amsterdam in Holland.
Let's go across the pond for our next part and hear what our adopted pilot, Neil Braden, thinks of 100.
Hello, this is Neil Braden from getmyppl.blogspot.com. The number I have chosen is 100, and that's the number of hours PIC I'm trying to get here in Arizona before I turn to Europe in about 12 months' time. Tucson Tower, Cessna 542-8 is on a right base, 11 right for a full stop.
Plug 1 contact Tucson departure. Cessna 54288 Tucson Tower, runway 11 right, cleared to land, wind 1703.
Clear to land, 11 right, 288. Come over to my blog at getmyppl.blogspot.com and enjoy my journey as I continue to fly around Arizona. Or join me on Twitter at pilot_NGB.
Thanks, Neil, for that creative recording. And whilst we're in the Americas, what does 100 mean to our favourite senior captain and A330 pilot, Carlene Pettit? Oh, and a famous author as well. Is there no end to her skills?
Hi, this is Carlene Pettit from the Flight to Success blog at carlenepettit.com. That's carlenepettit.com. And I would love to ship 100 autographed copies of my aviation thriller, Flight for Control, to 100 pilots for Christmas. Happy 100th episode across the pond, and happy holidays to everyone from your friends in Seattle, Washington.
Thanks, Carlene. And finally, we go high into the clouds around the Matterhorn with our regular Swiss contributor, Etienne.
Hey guys, this is Etienne Maillard from Switzerland, also at flight level 150 on Twitter. I just logged 100 hours as a private pilot, and I'm happy to wish you all the best listening to episode number 100 of Across the Pond.
Well, thanks, Etienne. And so, we now look forward to some new guests and subjects at an exciting time in aviation across the Great Divide of Ocean. But what I'd really like to do is thank you, our listeners, for being on the journey with us. You're a great bunch, and I really enjoy producing this material for you. Have a peaceful holiday, and may 2013 bring you aviation and aerospace happiness. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond. Oh, and by the way, Rob, where's my Airplane Geeks pin?
All right, let's do a few Grill the Geeks questions. We haven't done this in quite a while. Grill the Geeks is where listeners send us questions, and we see if we can answer them. All right, first question, and David White, you can play along too if you like.
Okay.
We actually got the same question from two listeners. This question, believe it or not, this question comes from John Arvin. And also, Randy D. also sent in the exact same question. And here it is. What is the significance of the registration number on Spaceship One? And that registration number is N328KF. Who knows what the significance of that registration number is on Spaceship One?
I don't have a clue.
Oh, David. Oh, nothing, huh? David, I thought maybe you would know this.
I've got to Google here pretty quick.
No, oh, that's cheating. That's cheating.
We have to know it right off the top.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
That's good, though. So here's the answer. This is really pretty cool, I think. So Spaceship One is registered with the FAA as N328KF. And if you're, Rob, how do you say that in, like, pilot speak?
Kilo Fox.
Kilo Foxtrot?
Yes.
N is the prefix for U.S. registered aircraft. 328 Kilo Foxtrot was chosen by Scaled Composites to stand for 328,000 feet, which is about 100 kilometers. Why that number? That's the officially designated edge of space. The original choice of registry number N100KM was already taken, so N328KF is registered as a glider, reflecting the fact that most of its independent flight is unpowered. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah, you are. Okay, here's one more. We'll do one more. This is from Charles. This is a general aviation question. Oh, I remember this question. All right, so Charles asks, In the event of an engine failure, when looking down for a safe landing field, why should you avoid landing in a big field with what appears to be a single cow? That's the question.
Because you'll hit the cow?
No. Well, that's not the answer that he gave. This is like a serious question and a serious answer, believe it or not.
Because you'll scare the cow and he might run in your path?
No. All right, so here's what
you might stop moving. That will be an utter catastrophe.
Oh my God, we've been working together too long.
Here's what Charles says. He says, because when it is a lone cow, it is most likely a bull who is very protective of his territory and will most likely charge the plane after the landing. He says, he heard a story of this happening from a teacher who once was a flight instructor in North Dakota, and this happened to a student at the school. He said the emergency landing was perfect. However, the plane was totaled after the bull had its way with it for being there. So thanks to Charles for that.
The fact that I said the cow might get in the way of the landing isn't close enough, huh?
No, this is being charged by the... Okay. All right, so...
God forbid you're in a red airplane.
That's right. Then you'll really attract the attention of that lone cow, that bull. All right, we have some more Grill the Geeks questions. We'll hold them till next time. I want to thank everybody who sent them in. If you've got a question for us that you think might stump us, you can email it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We got a really fantastic Christmas message from Jan in Italy. Here's Jan.
Hello, Airplane Geeks team. This is Jan Hendrik Günther. I'm sending you this message from Lake Bracciano in Italy. I listen to your podcast usually on my way to work in Rome. I'm not an aviation expert in any way, but I like to listen to your podcast a lot. Especially the airplane of the week and any technology related items. My way to work follows the final approach to Rome Fiumicino Airport, and I like airplanes a lot. So I wish you a very Merry Christmas. To you, the team, and all the listeners. Buon Natale a tutti gli ascoltatori di Airplane Geeks. As I'm German by origin, I will say it in German as well. Frohe Weihnachten an alle Airplane Geeks-Hörer. Thanks again, and I'm looking forward to your future episodes. Bye.
Thanks so much for that. Very kind. We also got a silent message from Ian Kershaw. Yes, this was a signed message. Very interesting, and he sent it via a little video, and if we can work this out, maybe we can put that video in the show notes for you. So I want to thank Ian and Jan for those wonderful messages. Next up, we heard from Dan Hampton, our Viper pilot, and this was on this question about the tensiometric throttle that we've talked about the last couple of episodes, based on, I think it was Fred asked the question to us a few episodes ago. And Dan Hampton says the side stick used by the Viper in Airbus worked extremely well. He said Fred's comments are okay, except none of us were confused. This is, I think Fred said that originally the stick did not move at all, and that the pilots really preferred to have some action in the stick. And Dan says we just preferred to feel a little bit of movement. He also says a tensiometric throttle is used on the SU-47, and he says, I assume it's governed by the same principles. Not sure how that would feel, but I'm certain a pilot would get quickly accustomed to it. He says it took him about a minute on his first Viper flight. And then also on our conversation about interesting reading, interesting books, Dan had some thoughts. He said, as far as books go, I'd say it depends on which war we're talking about. I'd say that Sagittarius Rising by Lewis and Fighter by Deighton, I guess that is, D-E-I-G-H-T-O-N, are two of my favorites. And he says Peter Townsend's Duel of Eagles and Robin Ould's Fighter Pilot are also superb. And then for fiction, he says, Dan says, I think The Wild Blue by Walter Boyne is excellent. And he also makes mention that his next book, which is a fiction book, is coming out in February on the 15th, called The Mercenary. And he said it's going to be an e-book initially, but they hope to be able to print it. And he also adds that the book that we talked to him about, Viper Pilot, he says is done very well. And the paperback is going to be released in May next year in 2013. So thanks to Dan for that feedback. We heard from Seekar. We haven't heard from him in a little while. He says he's been behind. He just caught up with episode 225. He said he's downloaded HGS Flight and that he loved it. That's, of course, the little simulator that we've been talking about on and off. He says he loved it. Of course, as soon as he downloaded it, he started a challenge round and failed miserably. But he had some tips. He said he figured it out and completed the career round of the business jet in one session and the 737 in the next two-hour session. He said, my wife couldn't pry the iPad away from me during that time. Now, here's his tip. He says the secret to playing it is very simple. One, make very small movements. And two, support the iPad on a table or your lap when you play. And this will make make sure that you have no inadvertent movements. So thanks to Seekar. I'm glad you're enjoying that little program.
That turns out to be really good advice because in the real world, using a heads-up guidance system, you move very, very gently on the controls.
Ah, well, see, I think that was my problem. I was being too, too aggressive with it, lacking finesse, I guess. Ah, well. John Arvin sent in a link from Avweb, GA fly-by-wire, Diamond says 3 years. And this is concerning, I guess, advances in sort of fly-by-wire systems and how they might be applied to general aviation aircraft. It says Diamond is looking at a system in which the electronics monitor the pilot's alertness, and if it detects a lack of response, it says, like, due to hypoxia or illness or something, that it would automatically transmit a code and initiate an auto land at the nearest airport. That's pretty aggressive. I'm not sure, but it maybe seems feasible eventually.
Oh, sorry.
Rob, you have little faith in the automation of piloting.
That a piece of technology in a small airplane is going to detect that the pilot is somewhat out of it and is going to land the airplane at the nearest suitable airport. Okay, well, I guess it's possible. Just like to know how much that's going to cost.
Yeah.
The thing that excites me about fly-by-wire and GA aircraft is it could allow for the same kind of inherent instability that it has allowed in transport category aircraft and in the military aircraft where, an F-16 or even more so in an F-22, the airplane won't fly without the computers. It would be a rock. This could allow in general aviation aircraft to get much better performance and better efficiency using inherently unstable designs, but controlled by wire. I'm sure the days of airplanes like mine where there's a cable between me and the elevator aren't gone, but it might be interesting to see what kind of GA designs could come out of something like that.
And another item on GA that came in from a listener, this was from Ray, who passed along a link for a story that says Brazil announces construction of 800 airports, which is it's just mind-blowing. The president of Brazil announced that they would build at least 800 regional airports. They say the quote from the president is, figures in Brazil are big. We plan to build 800 regional airports or more, and this would be for cities of more than 100,000 people. Brazil is a continent-sized country. We need more railways. Some people in Brazil can travel only by air. This is pretty aggressive. I don't know. At least that sounds that way to me. 800 airports?
I wish the Canadian government would build 8.
Yeah. Does Canada have a airport density that's roughly the same as the U.S., or is it different?
Well, we're far, far inferior to the U.S. Our pilots in Canada joke about, when you're flying 10,000 feet over the U.S., if you have an engine failure, odds are you're going to be able to put a dent on an airport. And in Canada, if you have an engine failure at 10,000 feet, odds are you'll be able to put it down within 100 miles of an airport.
Okay, let's see. We heard from Micah, and he pointed out that, and I don't know if we mentioned this on the show or not, but the French Appeals Court has overturned the manslaughter conviction against United, or really, I mean, it was Continental originally, concerning the Concorde crash, and which, of course, is, I think everyone would agree, is good news. He also passed along a link to a story that's titled The Untold Story of the Concorde Disaster. And this this article kind of raises questions about really what was going on with that airplane. Things happened to that airplane in addition to the you know, the apparent strip that was dropped by the Continental plane that was run over by the Concorde, that there were other things going on with the plane you know, before that, that contributed to this accident, and that this is not really widely publicized or known. And Rob, you've been kind of following airline accidents recently. I don't know if this article kind of smacks of just sort of sensationalizing something, or I don't know. Do you have an opinion on this article?
I think what I saw in this piece was something that was incredible. And I don't mean incredible from an unbelievable standpoint, but I have to admit, Mike, I want to thank you for passing that along. I passed that to, I can't tell you how many of my friends over the last couple of days. I had never heard any of this about all these other mechanical issues that were going on with the Concorde just prior to the accident. And so I read the story, actually, I read it twice because I found that interesting. And so I hope we'll put that in the show notes, because I think anybody that has any interest in what happened to the Concorde back in 2000 should read that story. And it is incredibly eye-opening. And I guess what I find the most amazing is that I'd never heard of that story anywhere before. Now, why didn't we hear that? That's what I really want to know.
And some of the things that, some of the items that the, are mentioned in the story is that it's claimed that the that Concorde was several tons overweight, beyond its aft center of gravity limit. It had engine shut down that, well, one engine was damaged, but another, you know, it was erroneously shut down. It was overfueled. It says it was flying too slowly because the pilot had pulled a jet into the air early to avoid skidding sideways off the runway and colliding with another plane. And it just kind of goes on and on. And it is kind of eye-opening, Rob. And, you know, I mean, these sound like issues that really should be, you know, part of any investigation into this crash. So,
well, that's absolutely true. And I think the one that I think really, really doomed them was when that, you know, the report is that the flight engineer pulled the throttle back on a good engine by mistake, and apparently did that without captain's knowledge. And of course, that extra loss in climb power was just enough to make the airplane impossible to fly.
Yeah, yeah. And,
I had never heard that until I read that story yesterday.
That's really something.
Seemed like there was an awful lot wrong with that airplane before it went to full power.
Finally, we had a number of listeners write to say that they did, in fact, listen to the very end of the podcast. Most of them really enjoyed listening to the bloopers at the end. So a few of the folks who mentioned that, Rich, David, Micah, Blake, John, and there were a few others as well. So I want to thank all of you for sticking it out to the bitter end. Thank you so much. All right, well, I think we better draw this one to a close. We want to thank everyone for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Guys, wait, I didn't get to sing.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm trying to end this before you have the opportunity.
It sounds like that was the plan.
That was the plan. We want to thank our guest this episode, David White, board member of the Northeast Council of Air Shows, a member of the International Council of Air Shows, and the current air boss for the Waterloo, Ontario Air Show. David, thanks again for joining us.
Max and Rob and David, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Well, we'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. You can find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, he's at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. And also his podcast, aviationextended.co.uk. That's dash extended with no leading E. All right, well, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DMVitterup. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, and I will post tonight's Christmas story to the blog. So if you want to relive it or reread it or just want to complain about it, go visit. But most of all, have a happy holidays, and we wish everybody, all of our listeners, a fantastic new year.
Absolutely. And Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Well, they find us on Twitter at Jetwine, on the blog at jetwine.com, on Facebook, and who knows where else. But the most important thing I want to say to everybody, because we may not hear from everybody before the end of the year, have a happy new year. Thank you for listening all year long. We appreciate you taking some time with us. And did we give them the address to send the Christmas presents and things?
Yeah, that's coming up.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 228. Those show notes will have links to all the sites that we mentioned on this podcast. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we also have a little Google Plus community, so you can look for us there. Last I checked, in the last few days, we had 100 people joining that community, so that's another option for you. And we're also on Stitcher.com if you'd like to stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet's got that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Now, next week is the Christmas week for us, and so we will not be having an episode next week. In 2 weeks' time, we have New Year's, and so we'll have a sort of a special episode for you, so we'll look for you then. All right, thanks everyone for listening. Join us next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Happy
New Year.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.
The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
David, Whitey sounds great. In fact, why don't you just do the interview yourself, Whitey, and then call us back and let us know how it went.
All right. David, talk to yourself. Tell us how you started the air show business. Well, let me tell you how I started the air show business. I have one of my finest moments was there in I think it was 09 or 10. They pulled my plane out of the Tomcat hangar on the backside of the field there and dropped the ropes between the two Raptors and pushed my plane in between the two Raptors and let me take a bunch of pictures.
Oh, that's great.
Got some great shots on Facebook. It looks like I'm leading a flight of three and the other two are Raptors.
Oh, that's wonderful.
This article by Steve Creedy in The Australian this week.
Pause while I open it. Oh, wrong one. I opened the one about relocating the headquarters.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll do that next.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I've got to talk and read. Oh, this could be tricky.
Yeah, well, works for me. What? Okay. What are we talking about, Grant? Oh, yes.
Yes. Tank, download me a program on Air New Zealand. Hello, operator.
Down at the coalface, but yeah, Christopher Luxon's saying here that if you start to think about operations, about the operations, our respective business, that doesn't really work.
There's not a lot in this one.
Let's go on and do a couple of Grill the Geeks questions. Kill the Geeks. Grill the Geeks is where listeners send us questions, and we see if we can answer them. Sometimes we can.
Music?
Huh? Yeah, I put that in.
The music in?
Yeah. The music comes. I put the music in later.
What?
All right. Are you guys ready? You guys are still there, right? Oh, no. All right. I guess we're back.
He's back.
All right. Oh, man.
So did we get the answers right?